Blog Talk Radio.
This is Rare Bird Radio. I'm Mary Tabor, author of the recently released novel, Who by Fire. My guest today is Robert G. Pilkey, the author, professor, self-professed aficionado of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, who has written a fascinating tome of a book, Rock Music in American Culture, The Sounds of Revolution. And we'll talk about this book today. Robert Pilka grew up in Baltimore, Maryland. He claims to have been born in 1905, graduated from Parkville High School in 1960, went to University of Maryland, graduated from Lutheran Theological Seminary at Gettysburg in 1967, and also claims to have had his first drink in the year 2012. And he writes books, a trilogy on time travel, aliens, and Abraham Lincoln, if you can figure that one out. We're here to talk rock and roll because the man knows everything. The book, Rock Music in American Culture, The Sounds of Revolution, is a 300-page compendium that covers the history of rock and roll in America and threads history, literature, film, Pilke's thoughts on art, creativity, and what greatness means, all inside the cultural revolution called rock and roll. And he talks about and quotes Soren Kierkegaard, Herbert Marcuse, Sigmund Freud, Hegel's dialectic, Paul Tillich, Marshall McLuhan, Jean-Paul Sartre, and Abraham Maslow. This guy reads everything. I've been reliving inside these pages my youth, my new discovery of youth, my love of literature, philosophy, and music, classical, the blues, jazz, and yes, rock and roll, and discovering why Pilka says rock and roll is, quote, America's first genuine revolution. We'll ask him about that. Welcome to Rare Bird Radio, Robert Pilka.
Well, thank you very much. And if that doesn't sell the book, nothing will.
And it's worth the
book. A person born in 1905 has had his first drink in 2012.
Yeah, boy. What's that about?
Well, it's absolute truth, of course.
right. Okay. Let's see, before we start talking about this, all this, if we can hear one of the songs that got both you and me hooked on rock and roll. Here we go for one sec, okay?
Let's okay.
See if this will go. Let's go. Okay. Here we go.
All right, yes. You got to get away with playing it on the radio, too.
Okay. So, that's the 60-Minute Man, Bob.
60-Minute Man, yes, I know.
Billy Ward and the Dominoes. Bob, talk about getting hooked.
Well, this was, I think you're referring to the times that I would sneak in my bed and listen to the radio at night so my parents couldn't hear me.
Yes,
and, I would listen to virtually anything on radio at the time, including Fibber McGee and Molly and all sorts of stage shows. And one day, my radio's knob broke, so I couldn't tell where the dial was. So I would just simply spin it around and find some music or something. And I came on hit these stations in Baltimore. I think WEBB was one of them. I was playing black music, which, of course, I had never heard before.
Yeah.
And 60 Minute Man was one of them, of course. And
yeah,
I was
with the Dominoes, yeah.
Yes. And it wouldn't play on, they wouldn't play it on regular radio stations or mainstream radio stations because it's obviously has to do with sex. And a lot of the music I noticed had to do with sex and fun and pleasure and dancing. And so I was hooked, yes. I was a burgeoning teenager with hormones raging and what better music than this?
Yeah, here's the big question, and since you and I know that the whole book addresses this one, So I want you to know, I know you can't answer this briefly, but I want you to get the conversation going with it. So let me ask it, and then you give us a short answer, and then we'll move on to pieces of really what your book's about. But why do you assert that rock and roll is America's first genuine revolution?
Well, a first genuine cultural revolution.
Okay.
Revolution is a pretty general word, but when you're dealing with challenging the fundamental values and fundamental beliefs of a culture, not just simply to reject them, but to replace them with something different and contrasting, that's a cultural revolution. The revolution against the British really wasn't a cultural revolution. It had elements of that, but not so much. It was a political revolution. We changed our politics, but we didn't change our fundamental values concerning sex, religion, freedom, ultimate freedom.
Yeah, you say that cultural revolutions always tend toward an expansion of individual freedom. But can you talk about that too?
Yeah, we're seeing elements of that now, of course, with the rise or the greater of freedom for people to associate with whomever they wish to sexually, and marriage equality. This has been a social taboo for years and years, and it's rapidly changing. That's just one instance of challenge to prevailing cultural values.
What's rock and roll's role in that, though?
Well, first of all, the music itself, and it's going to get a long answer here. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I may interrupt you a little bit.
That's okay.
Me. I'm going to try to interrupt.
Feel free
go ahead.
To interrupt.
Talk to us a little bit about this.
Music from I'm agreeing with Plato actually when he set up his academy to teach people to be philosopher kings and to educate his people in ancient Greece, his ideal academy. He was always warning that everything should be taught, but you better watch out for music, because music by itself is something that is a free creation, and one of the most free creations of all the arts, and as such, it's uncontrollable.
Well, you quote Kierkegaard on that too.
Yep. And quite a few other people as well, but
so we're scared to death of what music's going to do to us, huh?
It's uncontrollable. That's why the Russians wanted to control music, also obviously to skip a few years from Plato to the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
But it's always been considered to be a dangerous art form because it's uncontrollable. If you leave people to create music on their own, they will create something that they desire that comes out of their own individual self. So it's free expression of the self.
So this wasn't true of classical music, you would say, or?
I don't think so. No, classical music in the classical period, where all music is in a sense a reflection of its time, but in the classical period, what they were doing is reinforcing the idea that life and the world and reality had a certain set meaning that you could discover through reason, and everything can be well-ordered. In the Romantic period, they thought that the same was true, but you could discover truth and meaning apart from reason. You could discover it through the arts and feelings. But classical music as a whole assumes that there is a fundamental meaning. Yes,
okay.
Yes, interrupting.
So, yeah. Well,
I'm getting pedantic, aren't I?
Well, no, you're not. No, you're not. It's fascinating. It's fascinating. But one of the places that seems to be a marker for you, and the artist who's a marker for you, and as Bob Dylan might have said, the person who made sure that things they are changing was Elvis. So I'm going to play a little song, but not one you might expect, and you'll understand why in a second. Here we go. I'm going to play a song, and we're going to talk Elvis. Ready?
Okay.
Let's go.
And now,
Now, one thing's for sure, that's a velvet voice.
I chose that song,
Bob, because, as you point out, he sings it, and Frank Sinatra sings it. So let's talk about
And it was written by Paul Anka.
And written by Paul Anka, yes. You got to love it. Okay. So let's talk, you say, except for pop music, all musical expressions are or have been authentic in expressing the human condition, and then you move on to rock and roll, and then you move on to Elvis. And I'm going to quote you here a little extensively. And here's what you say, and then you get to talk. Before Elvis, there were rich and vital musical traditions among both blacks and whites, but there was no revolution. Before Elvis, there was even something called rock and roll, but there was no revolution. Before Elvis, there was rage and alienation throughout the entire – I love this writing – throughout the entire country, barely held in check by a dogmatically repressive and subtly authoritarian regime, yet there still was no revolution. Before Elvis, there were many people who embodied perfectly the tensions that lay just beneath the surface of the supposedly placid 50s, but there were neither symbolic nor actual revolutionaries. Hence, as John Lennon observed on hearing about his death at Graceland, before Elvis, there was nobody. Why?
Boy, pretty much damn good writing. I agree.
Damn good writing, and you wrote it.
And that goes back to the way I'm looking at both Elvis and later the Beatles as symbols.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked that up, this notion of understanding things through symbols and what symbols are, through my years at seminary. And
really?
I'm relying on one of the major theologians of the 20th century to explicate this whole notion of symbolology, Paul Tillich. Protestant
theologian. Well, talk about that as high as Elvis. That's going to be really interesting because you do it in the book, and I want to see how you do it now.
Symbols for Paul Tillich and for a variety of people, obviously, are not meaningless little doodads or logos. Symbols actually point to something internal. Something that's inside of us that means something. It points beyond ourself to an ultimate of some kind. Now, Paul Tillich, of course, was talking about a deity or the ultimate. Actually, Tillich doesn't believe in a god. He thinks there's being itself, but that's another little philosophical thing. But in any case, it's an ultimate that a symbol points to. And some symbols are able to speak to, and that's a metaphor, obviously, to speak to others.
How did Elvis do that?
Oh, not consciously, of course.
Yeah.
But symbols are not created by the symbol themselves. Symbols just arise within, that speaks to a large number of people and means something. And how did he do that? Well, in the simple way of putting it that everyone does, and it's a lot of truth to it, is that he took two elements in American culture, black and white culture, and merged them into himself.
Mm-hmm.
Not that he did that intentionally, but that wasn't his job or wasn't his intention, but that's what he did. He brought together the fundamental crushing weakness of American democracy, the question of race. And
the
first time that has been confronted like that, and he did it. Not, again, intentionally, but that's
okay,
what happened with him.
Would you name a particular song that did it, or was it his movement? His body movement?
Oh, I think it's more than a particular song or anything. I think it's the whole Elvis persona himself. Everything that he is and was did this. If you're going to talk about particular songs, I think he did it in his really early things with Sun Records, like That's All Right, Mama, mm-hmm. Good Rockin' Tonight, which I think mm-hmm. is probably the best thing. So those types of things began the process, but he continued it. He people confused him on the radio for a black guy at first,
mm-hmm.
but...
Wow.
But it was the open, and it doesn't seem open today, but the open expression of sexuality which again in American culture was so submerged and repressed.
Right.
But again,
right.
That's part of the Cultural Revolution to release and free.
Right. So then we see him on Ed Sullivan, and there's all this talk that it's only above the waist, but in fact, we did get to see it all, didn't we?
Sure. Pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So then there's sex, but the next one of the things you talk about next is drugs. And
sure.
before we talk about drugs, let's have a little music. And we're hoping this is working. So here we go.
Okay.
Ready for this one?
Okay.
Now, of course, that's Ray Charles.
Well, I thought you were going to play Everybody Must Get Stoned, but that's just another.
Well, that was one of my choices.
Or
I went with Ray Charles.
I
went with Ray Charles.
One.
And I want to talk to you about not so much Ray Charles, but when you talk in the section of the book where you talk about drugs, you also talk about the sense of self as outsider or outlaw.
Yeah.
What's going on there? What are you thinking? Who represents all of that? Who are the outlaws? What does this mean? Who are the singers? Go wherever you want.
Well, first of all, the music itself was kind of an outlaw music, and as you know, growing up in this era yourself as well, that this was, you know, pretty much scorned upon as music, as a cultural reality, and in a sense, anyone who participated in this was outside of the standard legal framework of society, not necessarily by breaking laws, but by living a life that was not the one that was designed for us in this culture. And that's what I mean, generally speaking, by outlaw.
Yeah.
But then, there's outlaw music and things like that. But it's that being the other side of the tracks, so to speak, in the culture.
So, do you want to name songs or bands or who's
you know
who's,
it's
it
who's, it,
who's,
it,
who's,
it
taking,
changed.
Who's taking the drugs? All of them, or before they get on stage, are they all high or?
Oh, I don't know. That's not the case, I'm sure. But the use of illicit substances other than marijuana primarily.
Yeah, yeah.
It's been a part of the underculture in America.
Yeah, which is why
pretty much forever.
Let's Get Stoned, because mostly you talk
right.
about you talk about weed. Yeah.
Yeah, that's. I mean, you can see that's gradually again. To continue the idea of a cultural revolution in progress, obviously
yeah.
that's taking place too. Marijuana is becoming legalized throughout the country, and
yeah.
I pretty much expect that to happen for most of the states pretty soon. So, but again, it provides an alternate state of consciousness, and that's something that was never acceptable within American culture.
Well, the music does it too, doesn't it? I mean, I would argue that music changes
yes.
my sense of consciousness.
Of course it does. That's one of the reasons why music is so dangerous. It affects people at a level that other arts don't quite get to. But again, the arts all do this in some way or another. If you're talking about genuine art has to disturb if it's going to be good art.
I totally agree with that. Absolutely agree with that. You know, part of what you're saying, I'm going to come back to that, what you're talking about art, I'm going to come back to
uh-huh.
that in a moment. But I have a question from, there's a book club that you graciously joined called the Who by Fire Book Club, although we never talk about this book. And this member of this group is, we don't hope that's not always, that won't always be the case, but that's the case so far, that this member, Michael, has a cue. That goes right at your assertion that, and this is you first, that all revolutions, no matter what their focus or nature may be, or how they may be described, cultural, religious, political, social, sexual, etc., face some kind of counterreaction from the institutions they seek to supplant. So here's Michael's question. He says, please ask the professor if he doesn't see a fracturing here in public audiences. Rock excites some and repels others, much like contemporary classical music, he asserts. It attracts a fanatical audience and at the same time pushes others away with equal vigor. How can this be? He says, is there no common ground in the modern arts as there was in the past, which is something we were talking about when the show began? What do you think?
I'm not sure there's ever been any common ground in the arts. I mean, I think that's what art has always done. It repels some, it attracts others. And I can't imagine any kind of art form that's worth the label art that doesn't do that. It must do that. If it doesn't do that, then why do it? It has no effect on people then. Music does it, painting does it, films do it. It always engenders something like that.
Let's talk.
Well, I was going to get back to what this person asked about the gender. Engenders a reaction. Yes, that's one of the characteristics of cultural revolutions, or actually any revolution, but specifically cultural revolutions, that they always engender a reaction, a counter reaction, and you have this process of the revolution proceeding and then meeting an obstacle, and then both sides. Reassembling themselves and then going at it again. But eventually, in my perspective, and in the perspective of others too, gradually the revolutions proceed to a greater amount of freedom, individual freedom, and individuality as well as freedom.
And perhaps ultimately a kind of harmony, a word you use when you talk about the role of rock and roll in film. For example, let me just give you an example, and then I'd like you to talk about it. But when I played 60 Minute Man at the opening of this, one of the reasons I played it is because, for me, that calls up the last scene of Bull Durham, where Kevin Costner and Susan Sarandon dance, and they dance to 60 Minute Man. So for me, the harmony that is achieved in that narrative is achieved with the identification of a song.
Okay.
What's your view of the role of film and rock and roll?
Well, you know, as you know, I have a thing about film and rock and roll in the book there.
Yes,
but
you do.
This is the blending of different art forms, and it gets back to this notion of Marshall McLuhan that I use all throughout the book.
Yeah, talk about that.
Where the medium is the message. That's the little slogan that goes along with it. But his point is that when you talk about the media, and I talk about obviously radio and television and film, and now with the new edition of the book, the internet and so forth. But each one of the media themselves has a particular message in terms of individual relations and human relations and in terms of values of sex, drugs, rock and roll, family, politics, the media itself, completely apart from what is being presented through the medium. And radio, for example,
How do you begin to see harmony between narrative and rock and roll in film? Do you want to name names or not?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure what you mean by the naming names of the film. In terms of harmony produced by the film and music, but there are some films that make use.
Well, there. What you say? Let me. I'm not being clear. But you say at some point in the book that there is a way in which we begin to see rock and roll as a big part of film, and you name a lot of films.
Oh yeah. Okay.
So that's what I mean. So in other words, the idea of narrative and music come together.
I see what you mean. Yeah. One of the films where I first noticed this happening was American Graffiti, I think, where the film and the narrative of the film was complemented by the music selected. And it's not just simply incidental music in the background. This is part of what the film is about. It's about the music, what the music is saying, and the film is saying it through another way.
Yeah.
They're saying complementary things in two different art forms.
Okay.
Here's
a song for you, and then we're going to talk this movie, okay, for a few minutes more. Okay, here we go. Ready? Okay, that's not Dylan. That's from the soundtrack, though, of a movie that you talk about a lot. It's called I'm Not There. It's a movie that I truly adore. I adore this song.
I couldn't hear it very well at all. But,
yeah, but it'll come through when I think others will hear it okay. So it's inspired by the music, and here I'm quoting you, inspired by the music of and the many lives of Bob Dylan. And you talk about this surrealistic story that proceeds, and we're introduced to six different Bob Dylans played by six different actors, Christian Bale, Cate Blanchett, Marcus Carl Franken, Richard Gere, Heath Ledger, and Ben Whishaw. The fact that this list includes a black youngster and a woman, you say, underscores the meaning of the title, The Real Bob Dylan is Impossible to Characterize. You may seek him, but you will not find him. Bob, you seek in this book, and part of its charm is what you don't find, what you can't categorize, and what I call art, invention, breaking the mold, breaking through, to say it in one word, discovery. Talk to me about that.
First of all, what was the song? I couldn't hear it.
It was I'm Not There, but it was the cover by Sonic Youth.
Oh, okay.
Because there were a lot of covers in the soundtrack.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I thought that was one of the most fantastic films I've ever seen.
Me too.
And I play it over and over again periodically.
God bless the Weinstein brothers.
Yes,
who produced
true.
It, yeah.
It's Dylan has become a symbol also, and it's a great example of a perfect symbol when you can't grab a hold of it. And you can't capture it, and within the symbol itself, it has to express in some way its own lack of ultimacy. In other words, that the symbol is actually pointing to something else. And that's what Dylan's doing. He's pointing to something else. And it may be just simply too simple to express his freedom and individuality, but I think that's what it is. But you don't want to honor the symbol as the ultimate. Dylan is not the ultimate, and to a perfect extent, he performs the role of a symbol of pointing beyond himself by refusing to be a thing that's capturable. And
you also use him as a way to transition to the Beatles. You say Bob Dylan and I, meaning yourself, and probably many others as well, have one thing in common: neither of us would admit at the time how much the Beatles have overwhelmed us. So as we're in our late part of our half hour here, let's hear some Beatles.
Okay.
Here we go.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take the bad song and make it better. Remember to layer in the uncle.
Okay, Bob.
Boy, I've never heard that before.
Okay, one of the things you say
it's our highest selling, our best selling song ever. But
is it really? I didn't actually know that when I chose it. But you say that for language to be lyrical, it has to appeal primarily to the emotions. It has to be rhapsodic and effusive. Do the Beatles achieve this?
Oh, of course. But others do as well. But yes, they do.
And why the Beatles are so important, even to you and, you presume, to Bob Dylan, even though neither of you would admit it at the time?
It's the it's the fact that they're symbolic. That's, you know, and as you know in the book, I have one symbol representing the revolutionary challenge to the existing tradition, and one symbol or representing a replacement for the status quo, the traditional. And Elvis symbolizes the rejection of the past, and the Beatles symbolize something new and different. And,
you would say, would you say, so you would call this the negative versus the affirmative? Is this where you're moving into the, we don't
yeah.
want to get too philosophical in our audience here, but you seem to be moving
Me
into,
either.
The,
yeah.
into the dialectic.
You're right.
And
mm-hmm.
Essentially, I'm going to give a definition that I found of this that is probably not going to be accurate enough for you, but I found this explanation that says, if you have two questions, are our lives so barren because we use drugs, or do we use drugs because our lives are so barren? The question is dialectical because it enables one to grasp two opposed priorities at the same time and view them both as valid.
That's
so is that what you're saying about Elvis and
the
Beatles?
It's not a bad way of putting the dialectic that I'm talking about, but this actually comes from Hegel. A position in history is taken, or historical development takes place, and then out of that historical development, it produces its opposite, and then the two clash, and out of that something new develops, and that's how Hegel saw the progression of history, and that's what Marx took from Hegel. It's a Marxian point of view also, but this dialectic. And what I'm doing is using the same kind of thing in terms of the revolution, counter-revolution, and something new emerging from that. Whenever you have any kind of genuine cultural revolution, there has to be symbols. There has to be something as a guiding spirit for it. And in America's cultural revolution, you have Elvis symbolizing the rejection of the tradition, the traditional values, and the Beatles symbolizing the substitution of new emerging values.
How did the Beatles do that? What are the values?
Again, not intentionally. This is not ever done
right.
intentionally. But ultimately, it boils down to the expression of the free expression of individuals, individuality, and an increasing amount of personal and individual freedom. And responsibility as well too.
Do you see the Beatles as a more hopeful take on the world then?
Oh, in the sense that they affirm something new, and in the sense they think, or I'm not sure they thought, but in terms of what they're affirming, it's a belief that it's going to come about. There's a hope that change will take place.
Music changes us, right?
I think that, and we change the music too. But in terms of this particular cultural revolution, where music has assumed the forefront in some ways of the arts, then yes, music changes us. You may remember that section. I'm not sure whether where I refer to the downfall of the Soviet Union, ultimately based in rock and roll.
it's hard to believe, but tell us a little bit about it.
Well, that's
you do
not
do
just
it.
Me. There's several books written about this, as well as the people that were involved in the Soviet government at the time too. The impact of rock and roll in the Soviet Union was let me back up a second and say, in order for any revolution to succeed, including the Soviet Revolution, you have to pass on the values to the next generation. And that's what is happening in America's Cultural Revolution. We're passing on these values and dreams and ideals and hopes to our children and to our children's children too. And it's being accepted and taken up with a gusto.
So rock and roll
is alive.
Down, does rock and roll bring down the walls?
I think so, absolutely. And one of the most interesting expressions of that was that I saw in I think McCartney's St. Petersburg concert several years ago. when he went out to, and that was, I think, the first time he played St. Petersburg. And the first sign that you saw in the audience, this gigantic crowd out there, it was a gigantic sign that said, thank you.
Wow.
So,
wow. I wish I'd seen that.
That's on tape.
Well, I will look for it. You know, Bob, I think I could talk to you for the rest of my life about this book, but I don't have the rest of my life to do that. I have I'm sort of over my 30-minute show here, so I probably need to bring the show to a close.
Well,
and
the
I'd
next
like
time I'm in Washington, we'll get together.
You bet we will. And I'm from Baltimore too. I don't know if you know that.
No, is it? You're
yeah,
from Baltimore.
I did grow up in Baltimore. Yes.
What's your high school?
I went to Forest Park High School.
Oh. Why would the park?
So we were on little other sides of different sides
yes.
of the town, as to carry the dialectic along here. Okay. Okay. So let me quote you first as we come to a close on the show.
Okay.
Were it not
that
for
book
Elvis,
is so damn good to read. Huh?
Your book is damn good to read. Yes. Were it not for Elvis Presley and the Beatles, the music of today and the revolution would not exist. And were it not for rock and roll, we would not be able to look at America today and imagine. I would like to quote my revered poet, W.H. Auden, who wrote this line, Bob. All knowledge that conflicts with itself is poetic fiction. Robert Pielka, I think you may agree that all revolutions, cultural or not, by their nature, involve both conflict and revelation, and we can hope for poetry. Today, I thank you for connecting with me through your book, your music, and this enlightening conversation.
Well, I thank
you
too.
And I'm going to go out with Eva Cassidy playing a song. And
okay.
You have a great day. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I've never heard that version before. Okay, I guess we're out.